Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And let me just begin by saying we have a very special show for you this week. On Monday, May 11th, the Obama regime gave conditional approval to allow the Shell Oil Company to start drilling for oil off the Alaskan coast this summer. Now, this is a major victory for the petroleum industry. Now, according to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, the same regulatory governmental agency that approved Shell's Chukchi Sea exploration plan in the first place, the chances of one or more oil spills occurring as a result of drilling in the Arctic over the next 77 years are 75%. And conditions in the Arctic would make it impossible to clean up even half the oil. Knowing all of this, the Obama administration has approved exploration. In light of all this, I thought it would be well worth listening to two interviews I did a few months back. First, we'll hear an interview I did with John Deans, Greenpeace Arctic campaign specialist, on drilling in the Arctic and why people have to stop it. Then, giving a larger perspective to the whole question of climate change, will be Michael Mann, who discusses the most recent report from the UN-established Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Dr. Mann is a distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. So without any further ado, let's jump right into the first interview with John Deans, Greenpeace Arctic campaign specialist, on drilling in the Arctic and why people have to stop it. All right, as people may have been following, Barack Obama has been in the forefront of paving the road for huge oil companies to dramatically step up the destruction of the planet. The continued and indeed increased deep water oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, the establishment of offshore oil drilling on the east coast of the U.S., and most horrifically, and I do mean horrifically, greasing the skids for all-out oil drilling in the Arctic. And here to talk with us about that and the overall situation as well is John Deans. John is an Arctic campaigner for Greenpeace, and he recently wrote, "Federal agency says Arctic drilling would likely cause disaster. Here's what you can do." John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
Tell me this, man, real quick. What did this new report reveal, and what's significant about it?
Sure. Well, this report is something that was required by the court. Environmentalists sued a few years ago that the federal government, when they offered this lease sale in 2008 under the Bush administration, had not properly considered the environmental impacts. And so this is their latest attempt to try to clean up their record on the environmental impact statement. And this statement lays out a whole laundry list of impacts, but a couple of the most shocking highlights are the government is saying if Shell finds oil, if there's oil production that happens in the Chukchi Sea as a part of these federal leases, there's a 75% chance of an oil spill, 75% have a large oil spill. So that's over 1,000 barrels. And they assume that there will be 800 small oil spills. Now, that's a massive impact on the local ecology. That will affect the food systems for marine mammals, for the fish. They talk about distinct species of salmon being destroyed. So it's a massive impact on the local ecology. And, of course, extracting more billions of barrels of oil out of the Arctic Ocean is only going to exacerbate climate change that's destroying this sensitive area.
Now, one of the things they also said in the report was that the report actually was changed because it raised the amount of, the recoverable oil that they could that they were saying was there in the Arctic. What's the significance of that? I mean, it went from, 1 billion barrels to 4.3 billion barrels?
That's correct. The problem is that the government had based their environmental impact statement on the potential spilling related to a billion barrels of oil being extracted from the Chukchi Sea. And as environmentalists argued and the court agreed, it was an arbitrary and capricious estimate. And so in this newest report, they've gone through and said, well, we think that 4.3 billion barrels is how much economically recoverable oil will be taken out. And that's out of about 12 billion barrels that they estimate are economically recoverable in total. They just think that 4.3 is the likely estimate for what would be extracted. And so we're taking a hard look at that and examining their methodology. This is a very complex report. And so we're trying to poke the report in any way we can to try to make sure that they are, in fact, giving a realistic estimate.
Mm-hmm. Now, the difference between that and the original report, which said 1 billion, what is the point here? Because I understand it was because when they were putting the lower amount, it was basically meant to indicate or imply that there's really not that great a danger of some massive catastrophe.
Yeah, that's right. They're trying to sort of brush this under the carpet, and this is the second time they've been taken to court, and it's the third round of this environmental statement that they've drafted. So hopefully they'll get it right this time. We'll see if third time's the charm. But yeah, that's basically it. The more oil that comes out of the ground, the higher the likelihood is for a spill, and the larger the impact could be of that spill. And so those things need to be considered. So we saw the percentage jump from, I think it was 40% chance of an oil spill up to 75%. And at 75%, I mean, those are good odds. So you can basically expect that there would be an oil spill if production happens in the Chukchi Sea.
Yeah, I read a couple of pieces that said it's pretty much a given. If drilling starts, there will be an oil spill.
Yeah, that's certainly what we've said all along, and the government's finally catching up to that. And the thing about the Arctic, as you said, it is horrifying because, I mean, look at what happened in 2010 with a deepwater disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, a just absolutely horrific impact. And look at what happened in Prince William Sound with the Exxon Valdez. These spills are bad enough in areas that aren't iced in for the majority of the year. But when you go up to the Arctic Ocean, they're basically saying, the government put out another report earlier through the National Academy of Sciences that looked at what we could do about an oil spill. And essentially, the leading scientists on this said, we can't clean up an oil spill in the Arctic. We don't know the basic science behind how to do it, and we don't have the equipment. So basically, the government knows that 1,000 barrels of oil or above spills in the Arctic Ocean, and most of it's going to stay trapped in the ice.
Yeah, I read somewhere where the U.S. Coast Guard has actually admitted that they have zero spill response capability in the Arctic.
Yeah, there's virtually no oil response capability. I mean, they set up a couple of stations along the coast there, but there's not enough equipment, there's not enough training, and like I said, there's not enough understanding about what to actually do. And the scientists were saying so bad that we want to go up there and burn oil to see what happens, which, of course, would be a disaster in all of itself.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm going to get into this a little bit more in a little while, but first let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with John Deans. And John is an Arctic campaigner for Greenpeace. He recently wrote, "Federal agency says Arctic drilling would likely cause disaster. Here's what you can do." Now, John, one of the things is there were four companies that originally were involved in this whole scene, and I guess there still are, but only Shell Oil has attempted to develop their leases, and they were forced to stop. And I think it's important for people to understand why they were forced to stop, because it's indicative, or it indicates what is possibly the outcome of beginning to drill oil there. Why were they forced to stop, and what's the current status?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Shell Oil is essentially the icebreaker for the industry in the U.S. Arctic waters. And yeah, all the other companies, ConocoPhillips, Statoil, and others, have said, well, we're going to see what Shell can do. And so far, Shell hasn't done a whole lot except for mess up. They've spent over $6 billion pursuing oil in the U.S. Arctic. They had one season where they sent drill ships up in 2012. Both of those drill ships ran aground. One of them they had to scrap. One of them caught fire. And it was just a complete mess. And that was just to sort of drill some exploratory, what they call top holes, where they're not even getting into the layers of the rock under the seafloor that have oil in them. And so we've already seen that a company has 100% success rate in completely messing up their operation. So we're going to include that as one of the things the government should take into serious consideration and say, look, you've got a perfect example of oil major going up, completely messing up their operation. So the likelihood of environmental impacts is really huge.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I'd like to get into, you know, it's kind of heavy because the environmental impact I want to talk about it in general first, because it involves so many things, including like the increased shipping. And I read somewhere where even something like that, where ships will end up discharging ballast waters and they're discharging microbes or whatever from other oceans, right, other seawaters, and what that would do to the ecology in the Arctic. But the impact of drilling in general, in terms of the damage that would do, let's talk about that for a minute.
Sure, yeah. In 2012, as Shell was making their way up to the Chukchi Sea, we actually sent our ship up there, and we did some exploring, and our campaigners and scientists went overboard in submersibles and surveyed the ocean floor, and we actually found higher numbers than anybody had predicted of the seafloor being covered in corals and brittle stars, and that whole ocean floor ecology is much more vibrant than had been previously documented. So it's a very vibrant area, but it's also very sensitive, and everything up there relies on everything else. And so if you start destroying the ocean floor and you start, you know, harassing animals with increased ship traffic and even the small oil spills, All of that adds up to a really huge impact. And in fact, one of the things we've also done, Greenpeace and others, other environmental organizations have now sued the U.S. Fish and Wildlife because they're basically going to give Shell Oil carte blanche to harass walruses and polar bears. And the drilling site is right near a critical habitat for walrus in particular called Hannah Shoal. And it's the ship traffic, it's the noise traffic, it's the harassment that could really lead to some really horrible consequences. And in the case of walrus, we've already seen that they're scrambling to find places to haul out. 35,000 just a few months ago hauled out. And it's a huge story. And they had to come out on land when usually they're trying to haul out on ice. So there's multiple impacts and they add up.
Let's move on to the impact of a major spill. That's the thing we've been talking about. We started off the conversation with that. What makes it so dangerous in these waters? What makes it so dangerous that you could actually say, well, there's going to be a spill if they start drilling? What is it that makes it so dangerous? I've read things about floating icebergs, the freezing conditions. Yeah. Can we talk about that a minute?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the issue here, the central issue is that climate change is affecting the planet. We all know that. There's no disputing that. But when you look at the Arctic, the effects are so much more extreme and so much more rapid. Temperatures rising multiple degrees. And what they're saying is that opens up the waters, which is true in a certain extent. But that doesn't mean that they're ice-free. So you have these massive floating chunks of ice in the summertime, which is the drilling season. And these rigs have to be designed so that they can pick up and leave at a moment's notice and be towed away or float out of the way of an iceberg. And it's just a very hard place to work from that angle. And also, you have a really short drilling season. So you basically have from July through October, 4 months, to drill. So what happens if a spill occurs in October? You don't have much time before the ice starts coming in and before that equipment needs to get out of there for fear of being destroyed. The water is colder. The oil reacts differently. The specific type of oil that they might find acts differently than, say, how it might act in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's a very unique environment. It's very harsh weather. And a perfect example is that when they moved their drill rig out, it's called the Kulik, it ran aground because it went right through a winter storm. And the seas, I mean, we've all seen Deadliest Catch and what the oceans are like off the coast of Alaska. So that's what you should be picturing when you're picturing trying to drill for oil in Arctic waters.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with John Deans, an Arctic campaigner for Greenpeace. And he recently wrote, federal agency says Arctic drilling would likely cause disaster. Here's what you can do. John, you know, it's very heavy when I was reading up on this. The point about if spilled oil got under these large bodies of ice, there's just no way to contain or clean that up. And those toxic traces can last a very long time and travel very long distances on ice flows.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the document, actually, the report that the government released looking at the environmental impacts is really shocking. I mean, you look at the impacts of the oil, and they talk about whales inhaling toxic gases that are coming out of the oil. They talk about polar bears being saturated in oil, losing flotation and the ability to stay warm. And this stuff lingers. We were in Alaska just a few years ago with some scientists digging into the layers of sand in the waters surrounding the Exxon Valdez spill. And there's a layer of oil there. So, yeah, this stuff sticks around. It volatilizes, so you get emissions into the air. It sinks into different parts of the water column, gets spread all over the place, coats marine mammals. It kills their food, the microorganisms, and fish that they feed on. So it spreads everywhere, and it's a horrible disaster to imagine.
Mm-hmm. I want to also revisit this point about the wholly inadequate response from oil companies to this danger. I read where one senior official in a Canadian oil company said that there really is no solution or method today that we're aware of that can actually recover spilled oil from the Arctic. And yet Shell says it can clean up 95% of a spill, while the U.S. Geological Survey says 1 to 20%. And they point out that the Exxon Valdez was actually, the recovery was only 9%. And in Deepwater Horizon, it was only 17%.
Right. And consider the Deepwater Horizon was in warm, relatively mild waters of the Gulf of Mexico compared to the harsh, cold, and stormy waters of the Arctic. So, yeah, I mean, those claims are absurd, and they're couched in very feeble science. And like I said, in April of 2014, just this year, the National Academy of Sciences, the best scientists that we've got, the National Research Council said, yeah, we don't know enough. So the leading scientists trying to deal with oil in different conditions don't know enough about how it will act in the Arctic. So having a company say, oh, we can clean up 95% of it is just absurd. And nobody really believes that. But the thing is, this is the moment where the Obama administration could take a real stance. Obama has just made very big claims on climate, is now starting to enact a lot of things. This is one area where they can say, look, you know, our own research, the court made us go back. We had to look at this. And our research is saying there's a 75% chance of the spill. We could be decimating populations of sensitive animals like threatened ducks that are protected under the Endangered Species Act. This project doesn't need to go forward. This is too dangerous. There is an opportunity here for the president and his administration to step up and really put their money where their mouth is and say, you know what, this area is off limits. We're not going to drill it. It's too dangerous. And can't afford to have more hydrocarbons and carbon going in the atmosphere.
Of course, then he'd have to deal with the situation that he just opened up all those oil drilling in off the East Coast and the increase in the deep water drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, even in the wake of the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, and it's absurd to think of opening up areas on the East Coast. And that still, you know, we have a chance to stop that, too. And people really need to get engaged in this. This is a very good opportunity right now for people to engage on these issues and say, no, look, we're going to draw a line in the sand. We're going to draw a line in the ice and say, you can't go further. This is enough. We've got there's deployable renewable energy. There's a whole new way we can charge our economy. We don't need these fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you one question around that, because it's very important that people know that Greenpeace is actually out there fighting this on the front lines of this. And I was reading recently where you had the Arctic 30 was a group of Greenpeace volunteers that were out there fighting the same sort of drilling in, and I think it was in Russian waters or something.
Sure. Yeah, just over a year ago, the area of the Arctic that's most under development right now is the Russian Arctic, and a state-owned oil company called Gazprom, who partners with companies like Shell. There are all these partnerships between corporate oil companies and the Russian state-owned companies. They had a drilling rig in Russian Arctic waters, and they still do. And our activists approached the oil rig and attempted to climb it. Were approached by Russian authorities who fired warning shots into the water around them from their guns, held them at knife point, dropped from a helicopter onto our ship, arrested the ship and its entire crew, and threw them in jail for a few months. And thankfully, they were granted amnesty as millions of people around the world cried out for justice on that. But a horrifying experience trying to suppress free speech. And, you know, our activists were incredibly brave and, you know, went right up against the threat, because who else is going to do it? That's why we're out there. We need to confront the sources of these problems. We need to bring the world's attention to what's happening, because the oil companies and the governments that they've bought and paid for want to keep this stuff in the dark and want to just keep on making billions of dollars.
Yeah, and just as a final thing for you to comment on if you want to, I'm just reading about Shell's spill response plan for an accident in the Chukchi sea waters, and it was recently approved by the U.S. government, and here's what it says. It's basically, the assessment of it says, even a quick read shows that the company would be entirely unable to respond to an accident in the high north. In fact, it's more like a negligence plan than a spill plan, depending on a capping and containment system that hasn't even been built, on deflection barriers that will not work properly on ice, and with onshore cleanup plans that look like they've been drawn by children. At the same time, we hear that Shell is also paying to train dachshunds to hunt out oil trapped under the thick layers of ice. Need I say any more?
Right. Well, and to add to that, well, I'll give you more, which is that in 2012, their oil spill containment device, which is basically, it's something they put over the hole that's intended to shut things down if anything goes wrong, tested in calm waters, not up in the Arctic even, crushed like a beer can, was the headline. So the device that they're relying on to be able to stop a blowout doesn't even work, let alone in Arctic conditions. So it's absurd, and we've challenged their oil spill response plan. But the problem we have here is that a lot of these decisions are political. Under law, the government can rubber stamp these projects, even if they're going to, you know, have massive environmental impacts. And that's why it's so important for people to send the message to the Obama administration, to the Department of Interior, and say, look, you know how bad these environmental impacts are. It's time to cancel this. It's time to close off these waters to oil exploration.
All right, John, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, take care, man. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again, probably sooner than you think, okay?
Anytime. Would love to.
All right, man. Take care now. Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with John Deans. John is an Arctic campaigner for Greenpeace. He recently wrote, "Federal agency says Arctic drilling would likely cause disaster. Here's what you can do." And folks, we really need to stand up and do something because these monsters are going to kill the planet. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Dr. Michael Mann from Penn State University about the dangerous, dangerous situation involving the climate and the future of the planet. So don't miss this. Stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Confessing to the Devil from Randy Bachman, and seemed appropriate. I don't know, just seemed appropriate. We're covering the continuing and developing and really more pressing climate crisis threatening the whole planet. And in this section of the show, we wanted to step back and put the whole thing into a little bit bigger perspective. And to do that, I'm going to be playing an interview I did with Professor Michael Mann, who discusses the most recent report from the UN-established Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. So without any further ado, let's jump into my interview with Dr. Michael Mann. The latest report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was basically secretly leaked to a number of news organizations. And what it says that runaway growth in the emission of greenhouse gases is swamping all political efforts to deal with the problem, raising the risk of severe, pervasive, and irreversible impacts over the coming decades. Here to talk with us about this is Professor Michael Mann. Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be with you, Michael.
When we last spoke back in April, we talked about another climate report that had just been issued by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that one itself was pretty alarming. And I understand that this draft report that was just leaked is a synthesis report combining a number of separate previous reports on different aspects of the crisis. Well, what's the difference between these reports in terms of content?
Yeah, so some of it is just sort of technical. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is an organization that operates under the auspices of the UN, but literally represents hundreds of the leading climate scientists around the world who get together and put together these extremely rigorous and comprehensive reports every 5 to 6 years summarizing the state of our scientific understanding of the problem of climate change. And so this is the latest round, the fifth assessment report. And so the way they proceed, they start out with what's called the Working Group 1 report, which is just the basic science. It's the fundamental physical science of climate. What have we learned over the past few years from climate models, from new observations that we compare to the models? What do the models project for the future, given different potential policy pathways that still are in our hands? Depending on what fossil fuel emissions scenarios we pursue, the models can tell us what are the likely changes that result from that. So that's the Working Group 1 report. Then the Working Group 2 report comes out a few months later. It describes projected impacts. If the climate changes in some particular way, what is the impact likely to be on food, on water, on human health, on national security, on our economy, et cetera? And then the final installment of the report, of the three-part report, the Working Group 3 report, is on so-called mitigation, solving climate change. What can we do about this problem technologically, economically? What are the feasible solutions that are available to us to try to mitigate potentially dangerous and irreversible climate change? That's really what the IPCC has been tasked to do back since 1990, when the United Nations Framework Convention first tasked the IPCC to assess, to not prescribe the solutions, but to assess prospects for dangerous human interference with the climate. And so the IPCC has been doing this now for more than 2 decades. The synthesis report is basically just taking all that information from the three different working group reports and summarizing collectively what it all says and what it all means when it comes to contending with the problem of human-caused climate change. And as you noted, the language in this latest synthesis report is quite stark. It's pretty remarkable because this is a very conservative document. The IPCC documents, by nature, are conservative documents. They are consensus documents where the final wording has to be agreed upon by hundreds of scientists with differing viewpoints. It's sort of a lowest common denominator in a sense because of that. It often, to some extent, understates the true potential threats because there's a range of viewpoints, and often the IPCC sort of ends up taking a somewhat centrist line between scientists who tell us that climate change is proceeding even faster than we might have guessed, and critics, contrarians, skeptics, who deny that climate change even exists. And so there's still a few of those folks within the scientific community. They have some involvement in the IPCC process. And so that necessarily sort of ends up watering things down a little bit. So if anything, the IPCC is a conservative body. Scientists tend to be conservative. They don't like to stick their necks out, you know, with questionable hypotheses, untested hypotheses, dubious conclusions. Scientists, by their nature, are conservative. And so what's so remarkable in this latest synthesis report is that a conservative body like the IPCC would use the sort of stark language that you were quoting earlier about the fact that we are now contending already with dangerous and potentially irreversible, on human timescales, on timescales that matter to civilization, irreversible changes in our climate that will be increasingly detrimental if we continue with business as usual, which is ongoing reliance on fossil fuels for energy.
Now, tell me this. I was thinking about this study that was done on the state of the oceans a little while ago, and it was really interesting because one of the things they said in doing that is that there had been all these scientists working on separate aspects of what's happening to the ocean.
Right.
And when they all came together, it just blew their minds because it was sort of so evident that basically the situation was much worse than the sum of its
yep.
of its parts, that the whole was much worse than the sum of its parts. So that's Absolutely. Similar to what you're talking about here, right?
Absolutely. You know, scientists, increasingly, we sort of carve off some little niche, some little set of problems that we work on because science has become a huge enterprise. There are thousands of scientists. There's so many things that we are investigating that to really be at the forefront of modern scientific research, unlike back in the 1600s and the 1700s when you had scientists like Joseph Fourier and Sir Rayleigh and, you know, these sort of citizen scientists who might, you know, end up solving four or five of the biggest problems in science of that century alone. That's not the way it works anymore. Scientists tend to be working on small parts of problems, making incremental progress towards our understanding of the way the world works. That's the nature of sort of the modern scientific discipline. And because of that, the sort of situation you described can easily arise. In the lack of sort of multidisciplinary approaches to looking at problems, when you take a problem like the oceans and you break it up so that, you know, you've got marine biologists maybe studying certain aspects of ocean ecology, fish population decline, but you may have geochemists who are studying the impact of ocean acidification. The CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere isn't just warming the planet and changing the climate, it's also acidifying the ocean, which is a major problem. You know, it's already a threat to coral reefs, literally. They will begin to dissolve. They will not be able to maintain their coral structure as the ocean becomes more acidic. And then you talk to people who study the effect of pollutants on animal life in the ocean. And so what happens is you've got all these different sort of communities of scientists studying different problems. And as you say, you bring them all together, and it may be the first recollection on their part that, hey, we're looking at a bigger problem than we realized, because this isn't just a system that is being stressed by one factor. And we all understand this in the way we live our lives. You know, if one bad thing happens to you over the course of the day, you'll deal with it. A couple bad things, well, it's a bad day. But if everything in your life is going wrong simultaneously, it's devastating. It's the whole is much worse than the sum of the parts. And that's true with living organisms. If they are subject to multiple stresses at the same time, they have far less adaptive capacity than if they're dealing with just a limited number of stresses. So when you hit coral reefs with warmer ocean water, which is causing coral bleaching, You hit them with higher CO2 levels leading to ocean acidification. You hit them with pollutants, effluent that runs off into the coastal regions of the oceans and adversely impacts coral communities. Even ozone depletion has been shown to already have had a negative impact on coral reefs. And so they're being hit by all of these simultaneous insults at once. And it's far more difficult to be resilient. It's far more difficult to adapt to sort of an onslaught of negative impacts. And so we're seeing that. We're seeing that with coral reefs. We're seeing that with Arctic ecosystems, with ecosystems where they're being stressed by climate change, but they're also being stressed by development, overhunting, overfishing. All of these things coming together in sort of a perfect storm that represents a far greater challenge for our environment, for ecosystems, for human civilization. The same thing is true with us. We are dealing with so many simultaneous problems right now. Climate change is just one of them. We're dealing with pollution issues, water pollution. We are dealing with loss of habitat, of biosphere. We are, in essence, like the coral reefs, dealing with simultaneous insults to our environment. And that makes the problem far more of a challenge than if we were just dealing with one thing.
All right, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Professor Michael Mann. Michael is the Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And we're talking about the recently leaked new report, synthesis report, from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, Michael, one of the things I wanted to ask you as well, this report indicates that there's a series of irreversible ecological and economic catastrophes if something isn't done quick. And I wanted to talk about what some of these things are, these symptoms of all this, or what's actually happening. What are these marks, these scars on the planet right now, and see if we can just get a deeper understanding of this. So in 2009, countries across the globe set a goal of limiting global warming to about 2 degrees Fahrenheit above current levels. What does this report indicate about how that's going, and what are the consequences of what's happening?
Yeah, so the number typically cited is actually 2 degrees Celsius, so closer to 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit relative to pre-industrial time, but these numbers are somewhat subjective anyways. Even 2 degrees Fahrenheit may very well put us in the danger zone when it comes to impacts on food and water and human health. I mean, we're already seeing significant negative impacts of climate change, especially being felt in regions. People who live in the Arctic are sort of seeing climate change ahead of schedule because of the faster warming taking place there. Island nations, low-lying island nations, Pacific Islanders already dealing with flooding because of global sea level rise. So we're already seeing dangerous climate change. But as we go down this fossil fuel highway, we become subject to potentially more and more dangerous impacts. And you allude to sort of these potential tipping points that we may cross, where, we warm the planet enough that we set in motion some changes that we can't undo. That's the irreversibility that we were talking about. The climate doesn't always behave as smoothly as we might like, which is to say you can warm the climate enough that instead of seeing just a gradual response, you'll trigger something. That warming will trigger something very sudden and potentially irreversible. And one of the examples that we're dealing with right now is the issue of the potential loss of ice from the major ice sheets, from the West Antarctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet. We think that there is enough ice that is vulnerable to melting and to calving into the ocean from those two continental ice sheets to potentially give us as much as 10 meters of sea level rise. 30 feet of sea level rise, not out of the question. And we'd be talking about, of course, flooding of the major coastal cities of the world, island nations, large parts of coastal U.S., Europe. We don't know how long that will take. That's one of the uncertainties is, how long will it take for these large pieces of the ice sheets to collapse and ultimately yield that global sea level rise? And the fact is, there's uncertainty. But the uncertainty in this case isn't necessarily our friend, because we are learning that, to some extent, things are actually proceeding faster than our models told us they should. That is true if you look at how much melt is occurring during the summer over the surface of the Greenland ice sheet. We saw just a couple of summers ago something we had never seen before. There was melt occurring over the entire continent of Greenland, everywhere in Greenland, even the northern and most high elevation regions of the Greenland ice sheet, there was melt taking place at the surface. We didn't expect to see that for decades. There have been a spate of recent studies in the leading journals showing that the West Antarctic ice sheet may be far more vulnerable already than we realized because it is literally being melted from beneath by the warming ocean. And that warming from beneath is actually destabilizing the ice sheet. It's melting the locations of the ice sheet that were in contact with the bedrock that sort of keep the ice on the land and prevent it from calving into the oceans. Those points of contact now appear to be getting eroded by the warming oceans from underneath. And so we may be already seeing far faster rates of melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet and the associated contribution of that to global sea level rise. And I could go on and on. There are a number of aspects of the climate system where we may pass a point of no return. And we may have done that already in the sense that we may have warmed the planet now enough that we cannot stop a large part of the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet from eventually collapsing and contributing to sea level rise. It may be too late to stop that, but it may still not be too late to prevent other things. And so the lesson here is that there's no one tipping point. It isn't like we warm the planet 2 degrees C. If we can't prevent a warming of more than 2 degrees C, we just give up. That's not the way it works. If we don't achieve a 2 degrees Celsius stabilization, we still want to achieve 2.5 degrees. And if we miss 2.5, we still want to stabilize below 3 degrees C because the more we warm the planet, the more we change the climate, the more likely it is that we see more and more of these potentially irreversible and truly catastrophic changes in our climate unfold.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Now, tell me something. I mean, just out of curiosity here, is they're talking about that there could be ice-free summers in the Arctic in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, and it's another example. If you look at the climate models, what the climate models have been telling us in general is that at current rates of warming, ongoing fossil fuel burning, sort of business-as-usual fossil fuel burning, if we follow that scenario into the future, that we would potentially see ice-free summers in the Arctic at the end of the century. Well, guess what? We're already almost there. So it turns out that the observations show that Arctic sea ice, summer Arctic sea ice, has been declining far faster than the climate models predicted it to. And we're still trying to figure out exactly why that is. What might be missing from the models that is preventing them from capturing, for example, the dramatic loss in 2012, where the Arctic sea ice had dropped to less than 50% of what it was just a couple decades ago. We're already pretty close now to ice-free conditions at the end of the summer in the Arctic. And if you just sort of extrapolate the current trajectory, it really looks like we'll be there, you know, in a matter of a decade or two, ice-free Arctic at the end of the summer, something the models say shouldn't happen for many decades. And it isn't just academic. It isn't just a scientific curiosity, because as goes Arctic sea ice, goes the populations of polar bears that rely on that environment. So this iconic species, the polar bear, is now established as a threatened species by the U.S. government because we are literally destroying its environment. We're melting the sea ice environment that it requires for its hunting. And that's just one example. I mean, if we lose that Arctic sea ice, then we fundamentally lose an entire unique set of ecosystems that rely on that environment. The Arctic ecosystems, polar bears and walruses that rely on that environment, and all the other animals and plants that are part of that system. If we melt the Arctic, we lose a unique ecosystem that won't be replaced.
You know, and that does emphasize this whole point about the interconnectedness of this all. And I wanted to raise something else in relation to this point in particular. Well, not the loss of this unique ecological setup in the Arctic, but something related to the sort of connectedness of all these problems. When we spoke last spring, we talked about what people were postulating then as a possibility, which was that as these ice sheets melt, that there's organic material that has been frozen over for a long time that becomes exposed and begins to rot, and that there's the possibility of the release of really large amounts of methane, and that can have very dire and different consequences in a certain sense to the atmosphere, yeah, to the climate. And that apparently just recently they have actually discovered the release of some methane in that Antarctic region.
Yeah, and so what one of the things that, you know, we've known for some time is that there's a large amount of methane that exists in a frozen form, either in the permafrost, the Arctic tundra as permafrost in the ground, or along the coastal shelves of the oceans. And it's stable at certain temperatures and pressures. That methane is stable in sort of a crystalline form. But if you warm the coastal shelves or you warm the permafrost even a little bit, you can potentially destabilize all that methane that was frozen. And methane, as it turns out, is an even more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. On timescales of a couple decades, it's 100 times, almost 100 times as potent as CO2. Over a time frame of a century, it's about 30 times as potent as CO2. So there's been this worry. This is another one of these potential surprises, these potential tipping points, something that can be triggered that we didn't really fully account for, that the models don't really account for. If we warm the climate and we stabilize that methane, then suddenly we get even more warming because we're putting all of this methane greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. It's another of what we call a positive feedback, which sounds like a good thing, but a positive feedback in this sense is a bad thing. It's an amplifying factor. It means we get even more warming than we otherwise would have. So the sort of $24,000 question then is how much of this methane really is sort of close enough to the point of destabilization where it could be released on a massive scale in a short period of time in such a way that it would substantially aggravate the climate change problem, the problem of global warming. And there is a debate within the scientific community. It's important to recognize that there isn't a consensus yet among scientists that this methane feedback problem is a major problem. If you talk to experts in this field, some of them will point to the fact that we are observing methane being released from coastal shelf environments. There was a crater that opened up recently in the Siberian permafrost that we believe was a huge belch of methane being released into the atmosphere as the ground, as the permafrost is warming. But if you do the math and you calculate how much of that we're seeing, it's not yet to the point where it's a serious competitor with the warming influence of the CO2 that we're putting into the atmosphere with fossil fuel burning. So it's something to keep an eye on, and it could potentially be another one of those aggravating factors that kicks in and makes the problem worse than we had originally envisioned. But at this point, it's potentially a distraction from really the fundamental source of the problem, which is our ongoing burning of fossil fuels and the increase in CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere.
We're talking with Michael Mann, professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And we're talking about the latest report from the UN Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change. Now, the report indicates that if nothing is done, then the effects of climate change will be irreversible. And related to that, it says that even if we act now, there's a risk of abrupt and irreversible changes. And it points, yeah, to, for instance, the idea that carbon released by burning fossil fuels will stay in the atmosphere and the sea for centuries, even
That's
if
right.
we completely stop emitting CO2 as soon as possible. What does that mean? What's the consequences of it?
Yeah. So, I mean, by some measures, we're already seeing potentially irreversible changes. That appears to be true with the melting of the ice sheets. There's quite a bit of evidence that's mounted now that we have already committed to a substantial loss of the West Antarctic ice sheet. We've passed the point of no return. It isn't like we could cool the climate back down, bring CO2 levels back down, and drive that process backward. that's not a possibility. It'll proceed no matter what we do. So we may have passed that tipping point. But there are, as I alluded to before, there are other tipping points, the collapse of the North Atlantic Ocean circulation. There are all sorts of these potential abrupt changes in climate that could take place, but we don't think we've yet approached the point where those tipping points are a threat. But certain tipping points we've already potentially crossed. And so by that measure, we have already ventured into the realm of irreversible climate change. Now, as you say, the other irreversible aspect of this is just the CO2 that we're putting in the atmosphere. It takes the oceans and ultimately the sediments at the bottom of the ocean, which slowly absorb carbon. It takes these processes thousands of years to play out. So if you put a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere very suddenly, it's going to take the Earth system thousands of years to remove that CO2 from the atmosphere. What that means is that we have already committed to an elevation of CO2 concentrations well above pre-industrial levels for more than 1,000 years. And if you talk to some of my colleagues, like James Hansen, the former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, one of the leading climate scientists in the U.S., Hansen has argued that probably even 350 parts per million CO2, which is where we were several decades ago, even that is too high. If we allowed CO2 to persist even at the level that existed during the late 20th century, that would lock in potentially dangerous climate changes. So we're already too high. Forget about trying to avoid 2 degrees C warming. We've already warmed the climate enough to put in play, to allow to unfold some of these more potentially catastrophic changes in our climate. There are scientists who believe that to be the case. And if that's true, if we are already above the sort of safe limit of CO2 in the atmosphere, and the CO2 we put into the atmosphere will take centuries, if not millennia, to come back out of the atmosphere through natural processes, then the implication is that not only do we have to stop fossil fuel burning and other human activities that are elevating CO2 in the atmosphere, we actually have to be implementing technological schemes, if you will, to actually draw CO2 down from the atmosphere, to literally suck the CO2 back out of the atmosphere. And that's an expensive endeavor. It's feasible technologically, but it's expensive to do. And yet, it may be necessary if the expense of not doing that, if the consequences of allowing CO2 levels to prevail at current levels, if that indeed has potentially catastrophic implications, we may have to turn to these technologies, carbon capture and sequestration technology, to literally pull some of the CO2 we've already put into the atmosphere back out of the atmosphere.
We're talking with Michael Mann, professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And we're talking about the latest report from the UN Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change. I have two more questions. One is the droughts. And particularly in California, there's a big question of the drought and the way it's impacting people. But I've also read things like across the Southwest and in New Mexico, they're talking about intense desertification actually beginning to spread. What about this? They said this could all result in a mega drought that's worse than anything in the last 2,000 years.
Yeah, and I saw that article, and whether or not one frames it in terms of mega drought or not, I'm not sure that's the most helpful framing. Frankly, I think a more relevant question is just the average drought conditions in the desert Southwest, the west coast of the U.S. Is climate change making that worse? That's a more basic question.
Yeah.
And the answer seems to be overwhelmingly yes. The California drought, this record drought, not just a record, but it broke previous records by a very large sort of amount. I mean, it's by far the worst drought conditions that California has ever seen. They essentially had to create a new color on the drought map that they use to communicate the deep severity of this current California drought. And we know that climate change contributed to that. We know that climate change is leading to warmer conditions. I mean, California also had near record heat, if not record heat, this summer, in at least large parts of California. So you've got this heat. You've got earlier and earlier melting. You've got less accumulation of snow in the winter, earlier snow melt from the mountains. You've got decreasing precipitation in many cases. So it's all sort of coming together, again, in this sort of perfect storm to give us unprecedented levels of drought in California, but also more broadly in the desert southwest of the U.S. And this is something that the climate models have predicted for some time. So what we're seeing happen, the desertification of the desert southwest, is something that the models have predicted, but we're actually learning that it may be worse than we thought. Another example of a surprise, some new aspect of the science that we didn't understand before that's coming into play and is potentially making this problem worse. There have been a number of studies now that suggest that this really odd jet stream pattern we had last winter, where it was extremely dry, relatively warm on the West Coast, and then we had the jet stream sort of crash down into the central U.S. and the East Coast, giving us unusually cold conditions over a large part of the winter. So we had this huge contrast between the West and the East in the shape of the jet stream. The jet stream was basically going north into Alaska rather than traveling through California and Oregon, which normally get all that rainfall in the winter. That was a lot of that was going north into Alaska, and so the rainfall and the snow at higher elevations. So that pattern, that particular pattern of the jet stream that led to those conditions, there are some studies now that suggest that climate change may indeed be favoring that pattern of the jet stream. So the climate models already said that drought was going to get worse in California and the desert southwest without taking that factor into account. Now with this additional factor, which we saw play out in real time last winter, with the possibility that climate change is having some role in that as well, the problem may be worse. Another example of, yes, there's uncertainty, but look, in many cases, as in this case, uncertainty may be playing out in such a way that the effects are worse or more devastating than we thought they would be. And that may very well be true when it comes to California's ability to meet its water needs. Obviously, this latest drought has been a major threat to water security in California, and that may be, you know, a sign of things to come. It may become the new normal. And if that's the new normal, then places like California have to fundamentally rethink how they are going to find the water resources they need.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Now, one last question. No matter what, it seems large-scale climate shifts are inevitable in one form or another, and their impact is going to be, I mean, a lot of it is known, a lot of it is sort of soon to be or discovered in a certain sense. But you've talked about, and you've mentioned this a number of times, that there are contrarians out there. There are people who are these anti, you know, global warming, anti-climate change, all this other stuff saying right. It just doesn't exist. And you've sort of done a remarkably good job in terms of just saying, look, dismissing these people more or less, just like, look, you can't pay attention to a bunch of clowns out here that are doing whatever. But you've spoken about how scientists are actually the real skeptics, and that lends even greater strength to the report, that the science behind this report and the dire situations facing humanity in relation to global warming, real and accurate. While the scientists are skeptics in terms of how they carry this stuff out, how they develop all this, this stuff, they are not agnostic, and that this is actually true.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And there are individuals and groups, many of them associated with fossil fuel interests or, you know, the Koch brothers who fund a lot of these front groups that exist to try to poison the discussion of climate change, that exist to try to promote misinformation, disinformation, denial of the basic science of climate change. A lot of that is manufactured. It's well organized. It's funded by special interests like the Koch brothers, through organizations like, you know, so-called Americans for Prosperity, et cetera. And in my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, I talk about my experiences at the center of the attacks from those organizations, those institutions who worked hard to try to discredit this iconic graph that I published a decade and a half ago, the so-called hockey stick curve. It became sort of an icon in the climate change debate because it very clearly demonstrated the unprecedented nature of recent warming. And because of that, it became an object of attack for those looking to discredit the science. I became an object of attack myself, and I tell my story in the book. But one of the things I also talk about in the book is the issue of scientific skepticism. In fact, I have a chapter called A Candle in the Dark, and it's an homage to Carl Sagan's wonderful book, The Demon-Haunted World, A Candle in the Dark, where Sagan talks about true scientific skepticism, and he distinguishes it sharply from pseudo-skepticism, from contrarianism, from denial. You know, people who reject the overwhelming scientific consensus about climate change aren't being skeptical. If you look at their arguments, the basis of their rejection of the mainstream science is the flimsiest of arguments that don't stand up to even the slightest bit of scientific scrutiny. Now, that's not skepticism. That's the opposite of skepticism. But they'll often try to wear the mantle of skepticism. They'll try to present themselves as modern-day Galileos when, in fact, I think it's Sagan in his book says something to the effect that, yes, you know, they did laugh at Galileo, but they also laughed at Bozo the Clown. And you know what? You guys aren't Galileo. So you have that. And I think a lot of that is becoming increasingly marginalized, as it should, in the discussion. And climate change deniers aren't quite getting the voice that they once did. Some media organizations are, you know, doing a better job in not falling prey to sort of the fallacy of false balance, where, you know, if you're going to talk about the latest developments in planetary science, you don't invite somebody from NASA and somebody from the Flat Earth Society and have a debate. You know, that's not the way it works. And it shouldn't work that way in climate science either, because the scientific community has reached a very strong consensus. The problem's real. It's caused by us. There's a worthy debate to be had about what to do about this problem. That's what we should be discussing. And interestingly enough, just earlier today, there was a report that China has now agreed to a cap-and-trade scheme. So now the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases in terms of aggregate emissions, they're lower than the U.S. in terms of per capita emissions, but the world's largest emitter, China, has now committed to cutting its greenhouse gas emissions through a cap-and-trade scheme. It really means that other countries like us have no excuse. We can't point to China and say, well, they're not doing anything about this problem. So let's have that discussion. But as far as the science is concerned, the scientists, as you say, true scientists who are skeptical recognize that there are things that are understood and relatively well settled, and that includes the fact that we're warming the planet and changing the climate, and that it is a problem if we don't do something about it. And there are other things that are still uncertain, and we're still trying to work out. We're still trying to understand, for example, how precisely climate change is going to impact phenomena like hurricanes and tornadoes. We still don't know the answer to that problem. We don't know yet exactly how climate change is going to influence the El Nino phenomenon. And that's really important because El Nino, as you know, living on the West Coast, has a profound influence from year to year on rainfall on the West Coast. It has a profound influence on regional weather patterns around the world. And so if we want to be able to make projections of changing weather patterns that stakeholders can take into account as they build adaptation strategies, we need to be able to better answer some of those questions. And so there's a broad area of research questions in climate science where scientists like myself and my many colleagues are still working actively to figure these things out. What drives science, what's interesting to us scientists, isn't what's already known. It's the anomalies. It's the things that don't fit and understanding them. In fact, I have a section in my book, It's the Anomalies, Stupid, because that's really what drives scientific curiosity, is not showing the other guy was right, showing, yeah, everybody got this right. It's figuring out the thing that nobody else has yet been able to figure out. And that's driven intrinsically by skepticism and critical sort of assessments of scientific developments. So true scientists, true good scientists are real skeptics, but the people who often try to pass themselves off as skeptics in the world of climate change denial are no such thing at all. They're the opposite of skeptics. They're contrarians. They're deniers. They are purveyors of pseudoscience.
And on that note, Michael, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Just a fascinating discussion, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Always happy to come back.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Dr. Michael Mann. Dr. Mann is a distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've come right up to the end of the show and the end of our time. We have no more time for anything but saying goodbye. Talk to you again next week.